In thinking about what I was going to talk about this week, of course, like the last 2 weeks, I was really leaning towards the issues of spirituality, white supremacy, racism. But, of course, there are several other things going on that also could have been reasonable things to talk about. But my mind was kind of made up on Friday about what we would talk about, and I'll mention that when I get started of what happened. And this topic that we're going to cover is a topic that is important to me because of people in my life. This has been important long before that, but it's particularly personal for me. So today's message is the first part of a three-part series we're going to do entitled Clobbering Biblical Gay Bashing. So on Friday, the president finalized a rule that takes away non-discriminatory rights from LGBTQ folks when it comes to health care and health insurance. And he did it during Gay Pride Month. Now, sadly, the roots of anti-LGBTQ mindset in the U.S. are, well, they're typically in Christianity. So let's take a look at the concepts and the Bible verses that folks use to gay bash in order to gain a clearer understanding of how, well, how wrong they truly are. You know, it's not the easiest topic, and it definitely can be a bit contentious depending on who you're talking to about it. Because of that, I've attempted to take what's sometimes thick reading, albeit important reading, and make it at least bearable and mostly straightforward. I've even tried to sort of just lighten it up a bit, some of that scholarship with a bit of levity from time to time. This is part one, as I said, of a three-part series. And in this first part, we'll be looking at sort of an overall perspective of the Christian church and biblical theology and its relationship to LGBTQ folks and equality. And then in the final two parts, we're actually going to look specifically at what's really just a tiny handful of verses that seem, at least on the surface, seem to directly address LGBTQ sexuality. They are frequently referred to as the clobber verses, hence the name of my talk. So let's jump right in here. You know, we Christians, we are good at a lot of things: helping others, dressing up on Sundays, quoting scripture, potluck meals, taking care of church members, weddings, funerals, worship. But perhaps the thing at which we are most persistently exceptional at is interpreting the Bible, then misinterpreting the Bible, then running amok in the world because of it. Honestly, we got mad skills at that. And history backs me up on that. We have used the Bible to support, promote, and act upon some pretty unchristian things: slavery, Holocaust, segregation, subjugation of women, apartheid, the Spanish Inquisition, which, as Monty Python tells us, no one ever expects, domestic violence, all sorts of exploitation. The list could go on and on. Oddly, if you ask theologians to pick one Bible theme to rule them all, most would say love. Well, love, grace, and forgiveness. Okay, fine. They probably would not specifically agree on a single term, but they would most likely name something that is in every way the opposite of oppression, belittlement, hatred, and marginalization represented by the numerous atrocities committed by the Christian church. More times than not, these atrocities are the results of trying to play God. pretending as if one group of people has complete knowledge of God's will and is more blessed or more chosen by God. Now, not surprisingly, the people who see the world this way are always exactly the people who also happen to belong in the group that they believe to be uber blessed. Lucky them. Time and time again, Jesus made it clear that we should not put ourselves in the place of playing God, and that, unlike far too many humans, God welcomes and loves us all equally. Period. But we keep doing it. We keep doing it. We keep doing it even though each time after we argue, name call, suppress others, and fight for centuries, falsely playing the role of heavenly judge and jury, we slowly realize we got it wrong. We realize that, in fact, Paul was not promoting slavery. We learn to contextualize his statements and letters. We become more skilled at interpreting the original Greek, and over time we decided to stop quoting the Bible to support slavery or the subjugation of women or racism. Well, mostly. Anyway, you get the point. Because we finally come around to realizing that, as Rob Bell's book once pointed out, biblically, love wins. Always. And so we find ourselves here again, doing the thing we do best, misinterpreting the Bible and ruining lives with it. We are, once again, ignoring the biblical bias for those who are marginalized, abused, belittled, and negatively judged. Ignoring the biblical directive to show everyone love and grace and forgiveness. Oh, I mean, sure, this time around we've sort of softened our approach, saying things like, hate the sin, love the sinner. But we fail to recognize that what we're calling a sin and the person we are calling a sinner, well, they're one and the same. A person whose sexual orientation is homosexual or bisexual or queer can no more separate themselves from their sexuality than a heterosexual person can. It's like saying, I hate the toppings, love the pizza. It's just not the pizza without the toppings. We just aren't loving the person if we don't love the whole person. I actually suspect that the softening of the language that we use has everything to do with making us feel better and very little with making LGBTQ folk feel better, because it certainly doesn't make them feel any better. As a matter of fact, the love-hate, maybe emphasis on hate, relationship that the church continues to push on this group of people only serves to push them into closets and into even darker places, which sometimes leads to suicide. The church and its approach to this issue are at fault for most of the hurt, anguish, self-doubt, abuse, and death associated with being LGBTQ. It's not very loving. It's not very grace-filled. But it certainly leaves us in need of forgiveness. Many, many Christians have lost their way in this twisty, turny maze of how to practice our faith. We would much rather reinforce the things we want to believe than believe the sometimes difficult teachings of Jesus, who, on a side note, actually never said a word about homosexuality, but did tell us to gouge out our lustful eyes, which seems to me seems more likely to leave us all blind than the whole eye for an eye thing. Now, unfortunately, many Christians try to use the Bible as if it is a sex manual, telling us what is and isn't acceptable to God, thereby in their minds delineating out those whom it is okay for us to judge and towards whom it is okay to direct all kinds of nastiness and holier-than-thou-isms. You know, the reality is the Bible is not a sex manual. I know, shocker, right? And actually, it's a good thing. Depending on your particular level of sexual prudishness, personally, compared to the Bible, mine is pretty high. You see, the Bible not only promotes marriage between a man and a woman, but it insists that that marriage be within the same faith. And not only should a wife be subordinate, Ephesians 5:22, but she should also prove her virginity lest she be stoned, Deuteronomy 22:20-21. Oh, and the whole thing would probably be much better if it were arranged. That's Genesis 24:37-38. And that is just the warm-up act. According to the Bible, if a woman's husband dies, and she hasn't had a son, she must marry his brother and have intercourse with him until she has a son. That's Mark 12:18-27. And sometimes, biblically, wives are good, but concubines are better. You see, many of the men of God, were not only married, but at least three of them had more than one concubine. That's Abraham, Caleb, and Solomon. And they remained men of God. But like I said, biblical wives are good, and there's no such thing as too much of a good thing, right? So why not have many wives? God frequently blessed polygamists like Esau, Jacob, Gideon, David, Solomon. As far as sexuality in the Bible's perspective on women as property and slaves, well, you can imagine it doesn't get much better. The point is this. Most of us have matured enough theologically to recognize that we need to contextualize the writings of the Bible, and because of it, we've moved past using these examples as the end-all, be-all of acceptable practices of sexuality. However, somehow we've not managed to apply the very same understanding to the Bible verses that have become known as the clobber verses in the Bible. Clobber, because they're verses that are most used to clobber people who are gay or support gay rights. Now, that's really interesting when you consider that of all the topics that I just mentioned, sexual orientation is the only one that is not a choice. Polygamy, concubines, marrying your brother's widow, all choices. And we've decided to get over the biblical directives for them. But sexual orientation, not a choice. And so many Christians just aren't able to get past that one. Now, equally interesting to consider, it's actually more of a choice to judge and to marginalize people over being homosexual, bisexual, queer, than it is actually to be homosexual, bisexual, or queer, or transsexual. We judge them. We judge them and not ourselves. Since so many Christians clearly have a difficult time letting go of the clobber verses, I'm going to spend the next couple of weeks and take them one by one and very briefly consider what is really going on in them. And it should help us arrive at a clearer picture of what the writers of these scripture what they were actually trying to tell us. And what we'll find is this. As we get caught up in judging others over what we want the verses to say, we miss the understanding the opportunity of understanding how to be the people that we are being called to be. As we get started, we all sort of need to be on the same page on this thing, this one kind of large thing. When the Bible was written, the sky was thought to be a solid dome containing windows, and the sun orbited around the earth, and the idea of a person having a sexual orientation, well, it was a completely foreign idea. There is some debate who actually kick-started the understanding of, well, sexual orientation, but it's clear that the concept of people having a sexual orientation was first introduced in the 1800s. The 1800s, making it, in comparison to the Bible, a thoroughly modern concept. Clearly, there are a few Bible verses that involve same-sex acts, and of those, almost all of them are male. But given the modern advent of recognizing the existence of, well, sexual orientation, we must accept the reality that the writers of those verses were in no way trying to, let alone be capable of, acknowledging, understanding, and addressing homosexual orientation. So the question is, what then might they have been trying to tell us in those clobber verses? Well, I hope that you'll join us next week as we take a closer look at a few of them. And until then, I thank you again for joining us for this message this morning. If you're able to, please stay home. When you have to go out, wear your mask. Make sure you wash your hands. And as always, love one another. Thank you for tuning in.